Our third speaker is Lori Weintraub. Lori, like Gail, does research in two different centuries. She is professor of history, but also director of the Holocaust Center at Wagner College in Staten Island. Staten Island will prove to be relevant here. She has recently co-edited a volume called Beyond Bystanders, Educational Leadership for a Human Culture in a Globalizing Reality. And also, in 2012, Maternalism Reconsidered, Motherhood, Welfare, and Social Policy in the 20th Century. The work she's going to be presenting us today grew out of a project with the New York Genealogical and Biographical Society, and the title of her talk is Huguenot Refugees in New York, Faith, Family, Slavery, and Legacy.
Thank you, Dina. Look, it's working.
Yes.
Okay. Where do I click it to? This way? Okay. Hi. In 1664, the New Netherlands City Council took note of the French families that were to arrive here from La Rochelle and Ile de Ré, an island off the Atlantic coast. Among them was François Martineau, the seventh and youngest child of a salt collector. His migration coincided with an accelerated campaign by King Louis XIV to convert his subjects to Catholicism by limiting political and economic rights and freedom of worship. By 1670, Martineau owned land in Harlem and joined the French Church of New York, L'Église de Saint-Esprit, until moving again to Staten Island. It's hard to see. There, at age 37, he married a young widow, Hester Luton, and soon fought to help establish the first European place of worship. The new Calvinist church, known as the French Church, enabled congregants to worship in freedom and in their own language on another island of the Atlantic Ocean. The 3,000 Huguenots who fled to America for both economic opportunity and freedom were part of the Refuge Atlantique, integrated into a larger Protestant Anglo-Dutch American space. 800 Huguenot refugees settled in the colony of New York, more than in Virginia, South Carolina, or New England. With 172 adults and children, Staten Island was home to more Huguenots than Boston. Like the settlement of New Rochelle on the Hudson River, Staten Island combined the advantages of rural life with access to the New York port. The traces of this heritage are in plain sight. Staten Island boasts the only neighborhood in New York City that bears the name Huguenot. Many streets, libraries, and parks carry family names such as Andrevet, Bedine, Cortelyou, Goyon, and La Tourette. This presentation argues that 17th century Staten Island offered Huguenots freedom and security among clusters of compatriots and creolization, despite religious, political, and economic challenges. I conclude with some observations about the 1924 300th anniversary of religious freedom. Huguenot experiences in New York raise important questions regarding global migration, assimilation, and acculturation. Yale University historian John Butler argues that it is the arrival of the French and English in the decades after 1670 that ensured New York, quote, one crucial element of its modern identity. Immigrant minorities dominated the population. In her excellent study Before the Melting Pot, historian Joyce Goodfriend concludes that the dynamic interactions of diverse religious and ethnic groups, rather than Anglicanization or Dutch rule, shaped and defined New York. Indeed, Huguenots accounted for 10% of the population of 4,200 in 1695 Manhattan, and an even higher percentage in Staten Island. Unique among New York's white immigrant groups, the Huguenots had experienced persecution and exile. Those who fled took great risk as part of a refugee exodus from France that numbered over 200,000 between 1520 and 1720. Their legacy was profound, as the historian Bertrand Van Rambecki writes, by resisting absolutism and intolerance, the Huguenots acted as a precursor to modernity. In 1624, Protestants had begun planting roots in New Netherlands only a few years before King Louis XIII initiated the tragic siege of La Rochelle in 1627. To facilitate economic development on Staten Island, the Dutch West India Company granted a patroonship to David de Vries of Dutch descent, but born in La Rochelle, where his father was a merchant. Yet Dutch raids on New Amsterdam led to a cycle of violence. My people were murdered on Staten Island by the Indians of the Raritans, and so my colony was smothered at its birth, DeVries noted. Only in 1661 was Huguenot settlement on Staten Island, led by French-speaking Walloon Pierre Biou. Biou, a silk weaver, sailed from the Netherlands, accompanied by his wife Francois Dubois of Reims and their four children. Due to its distance from Fort Amsterdam, a garrison of soldiers provided, quote, a defense against the attacks of the savages. For the next decade, Dominie Samuel Dricius traveled by ferry there, weather permitting, to administer the Lord's Supper once every 2 months, as the French, quote, on Staten Island would gladly have a preacher but are very poor. Huguenots huddled together on contiguous farms on Staten Island, according to Dutch travelers Jasper Jankerts and Pieter Tersluder in their 1679 journal. Quote, we went from one plantation to another, for the most part belonging to the French, who showed us every kindness because we conversed with them in French. Their journal highlights the unusual presence of former Huguenot military officers who had served as soldiers under Wilhelm, the Prince of Orange. In probate records, many Huguenot settlers identified as planters or yeomen. Marc Dissosway of Picardy, who established a gristmill on Staten Island, listed his occupation as farmer in his 1713 will, despite his origins as a skilled wool carder in Amiens. The shift in professional occupations of Huguenots predicted a major pattern for immigrants in America down to the beginning of the 21st century. A controversy in the 1680s revealed the strength of the French language, the importance of the Reformed Church, and a spirit of protest. In June 1682, Reverend Morgan Jones, an Anglican minister, faced hostility in Staten Island to the tax levied for his support. Appointed by the acting Governor General of New York, Anthony Brockholst, a Catholic, Jones had a similar experience in his prior post in Queens County. In January of 1683, Francois Martineau presented a petition to Brockholst, arguing that the majority of Staten Islanders refused to contribute to the salary of this, quote, pretended minister in orders because of his, quote, ill life and conversation. The Justice of the Peace, Richard Stilwell, contended in his report to the governor that the real reason for the opposition to Jones' ministry was that, quote, the French and Dutch could not understand him, although in the petition they cloak it with other pretenses. The appointment of clergy might have been common in the hierarchical Anglican Church, but Calvinists adhered to the rule that a minister ordained in the Reformed Church must be called to the pulpit by the congregation. To the Staten Island petitioners, Reverend Jones had been imposed upon them without their consent. The more traditional Calvinist taste of Huguenots led to the formation by the early 1680s of a separate congregation on Staten Island, served periodically by Reverend Pierre Daillet of New York City. Daillet may have played a role in galvanizing opposition on Staten Island to Jones's ministry. Daillet, who spoke Dutch, English, and French, arrived in New York in 1682 after the closing of the Protestant Academy at Semur, where he taught. By challenging the legality of Jones' appointment, the Calvinists challenged the authority of the colony's government and church-state relations. In 1685, Protestants in New York were alarmed by the accession of the less tolerant King James II, the last Catholic to occupy the English throne. James dissolved the New York Assembly and declared null and void certain rights. The 1685 revocation of the Edict of Nantes introduced more drastic punishments in France. Although there were few Catholics in New York, a rumor that 200 Catholic soldiers had landed on Staten Island caused a panic. In his 1689 affidavit, the Huguenot silversmith Bartholomew de Leroux wrote that residents, quote, had left their plantations and were running to the woods, and we went the next morning to Staten Island, where the first news we had was that they were afraid to lay in their beds for fear of the Papists. He continued, Mr. Vincent, a Frenchman, had left his house and taken his family in his boat and lay upon the river for fear of these relations. In what became known as the Leisler Rebellion, militia captain and German-born merchant Jacob Leisler organized armed opposition to the government. Leisler's highly charged anti-Catholic rhetoric contributed to his appeal. Leisler issued warrants for the arrest of Catholic officials, including the former governor of New York, Thomas Dongan, who fled his Staten Island estate, Castleton Manor. Many Staten Islanders took part. Jacques Pouillon, who would later lay out most of the roads of Staten Island, and John Bodine carried out orders to confiscate the property of Matthew Plowman, a Catholic official from Elizabethtown, New Jersey. Several Huguenot militiamen from Staten Island joined an attack on the government in Albany, led by Jacob Milborn. Leisler's rule in southern New York lasted 2 years before he and his close associates were arrested, found guilty of treason, and sentenced to death. Petitions were circulated by Leisler's sympathizers in Westchester County and on Staten Island asking for clemency, followed by, quote, several riots and tumults in support of the condemned men. In response to this activism, all the condemned were given stay of execution, except Leisler and Milbourn, who were hanged on a rainy Saturday in May of 1691. Although Leisler and his followers, including those on Staten Island, ultimately failed, their brief tenure in office represented, quote, North America's most radical experiment in Calvinist state building, according to Owen Stanward. The insurgency in New York against English colonial authority promoted notions such as no taxation without representation, the decentralization of government authority, the right of people to bear arms, the abolition of monopolies, and a return to Calvinist values, states historian David Voorhees, goals which would be repeated by the American revolutionaries a century later. In 1698, Staten Island's Calvinist population had grown to 36 families, enough to support a settled minister, David de Bonrepaux. Jean Belleville of the Ile de Ré, a cousin of François Martineau, and his wife Hester deeded the land for the French church. John La Tourette, a carpenter from the village in the French Pyrenees who had fled to Frankfurt, Rotterdam, and London, helped in the construction. Starting in 1705, Reverend Bonrepaux decided to allow use of the French church for Anglican religious services as well. Staten Islanders now belong to a variety of Protestant sects, Anglican, Dutch Reform, Presbyterian, and Moravian, creating a potential source of conflict. The Anglican Reverend Aeneas Mackenzie sought to attract more adherents. He asked the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel to send him prayer books written in Dutch and French, noting, quote, the few I had have gained some of them already to our form of worship. Offering classes in English, reading, writing, and arithmetic, as well as the Anglican Book of Common Prayer, Mackenzie drew a diverse group of students, including slaves, which he referred to as, quote, all the nations under heaven. By 1735, most Huguenot descendants chose to join the Anglican congregation. This success resulted from several factors: Reverend Bonrepaux's conciliatory attitude, the high rates of intermarriage between the island's Huguenot and Anglicans, and the political and economic connections associated with the Anglican faith in New York. Staten Island's early 18th century commercial agriculture relied on slave labor. Estate inventories and wills from Staten Island, including the Bedine, Poyon, Leconte, Cocheron, Dissessway, and many others, included slaves used for farming wheat, barley, rye, and maize. As in the colony of New York, the percentage of slaves grew from 10% in 1700 to 18% in 1723. That is, 101 men, 63 women, 42 female children, and 45 male children were enslaved in an overall population of 1,500. Slaves also worked alongside white workers and artisans. The tanner Samuel Grasset, born in 1676 in La Rochelle, lived with his slaves in a house that served as both residential space and tannery. His father, Auguste Grasset, was killed in the 1712 slave revolt that led to the enactment of the harsh Black Code in New York. Evidence of the skills, language, and hardships of the slaves owned by Huguenot and their descendants comes from many sources, including ads for runaway slaves in the New York Gazette. Jack, a slave who had run away from the farm of Jacob Mercereau of Huguenot descent, was, quote, a weaver by trade and spoke good English and Dutch. The recapture of 14-year-old Harry, a runaway slave who, quote, speaks good French and has lost one of his foreteeth, would earn a 20-shilling reward. Wills of families of Huguenot descendants also reveal the tragic practice of breaking up slave marriages and families. While John Butler's early studies of Huguenot attributed slaveholding in New York and South Carolina to imitation of the British, more recent work has emphasized the significant transatlantic investments in the slave trade of Huguenot merchants, notably those from La Rochelle. What is the legacy of these Huguenot on Staten Island? In the mid-19th century, a revival of ethnic pride emerged among their descendants. The foundation in 1852 of the Société de l'Histoire du Protestantisme Français, which would connect Huguenot societies around the globe, strengthened this, quote, invented tradition. Industrialization, and for New York, the influx of Irish Catholic immigrants may have also been a factor. I will briefly share a few local examples. Henry David Thoreau, the acclaimed American poet and naturalist of Huguenot descent, came to Staten Island in 1843 to further his literary career and as a tutor. 6 years later, he wrote romantically that New England's mountains, quote, reminded me of the homesteads of the Huguenot on Staten Island off the coast of New Jersey. Huguenot, who were the first settlers, placed their house quite within the land in rural and sheltered places from which they looked out over miles of forest and stretching salt marsh and over the leagues of the Atlantic to that Europe from whence they came. This vision was captured on canvas by the celebrated Hudson River School artist and Staten Island native Jasper Cropsey in his 1843 painting, Cortelyou Farm. Cropsey's parents, Jacob Rizzo Cropsey and Elizabeth Hillier Cortelieu, were Huguenot descendants and devout members of the Dutch Reformed Church. And in 1863, the Rizzo family of the Ile de Ré was remembered by their great-granddaughter Suzanne Van Pelt with this memorial dedicated to, quote, the Huguenot who left France when persecuted for their religion, sacred be their dust. In 1924, the United States Congress printed commemorative stamps and coins to mark the settling of the New Netherlands and Middle States in 1624 by Walloons and Huguenot. The Huguenot Walloon New Netherlands Tercentenary Commission selected Huguenot Park, Staten Island, as the site to dedicate a national memorial Huguenot church for the 300th anniversary of religious freedom. They were honoring, quote, religious freedom and civic liberty, the two chief cornerstones of any good government, the Dutch ambassador reminded an audience of 2,000 people. In homage to Huguenot hardship, he added, quote, the American people demonstrate the truth of the saying that the way to breed a fine race of men is to cross them with persecution. Congratulatory messages were broadcast from a radio station at the top of the Eiffel Tower in Paris. As we celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Reformation this year, few visitors to New York would associate Staten Island with French-speaking immigrants and refugees. Yet a tour of the Huguenot footprint in the borough would be an extensive undertaking. The Memorial Church, the 1664 B.U. Perrine-Stilwell House, and many other houses of descendants and many street names remind us of their legacy. These French diaspora sites testify to the struggle for liberty and opportunity that reshaped the Atlantic world. For those in both France and the United States, grappling to understand and accurately convey the multi-ethnic foundations of their nation's past, this island in the Atlantic, Staten Island, can no longer be ignored. Thank you.